Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in the East. Proof that the big lie of a stolen election is the animating principle of today's Republican Party is everywhere today, not just on Capitol Hill, where Republicans are trying to oust Liz Cheney from her leadership post for telling the truth about the 2020 election, but in states all across the country now. In Arizona, where a shadowy company run by a Trump-supporting conspiracy theorist is auditing millions of votes, Democratic Secretary of State Katie Hobbs is sounding the alarm about how those ballots are being handled. From the Washington Post reporting on this, quote, ballots have been left unattended on counting tables. Laptop computers sit abandoned, at times open, unlocked, and unmonitored. Procedures are constantly shifting, with untrained workers using different rules to count ballots. Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs on Wednesday sent a letter outlining a string of problems that she said observers from her office have witnessed at the Republican-led recount of the 2020 presidential election results in Arizona's largest county. And now the Department of Justice is stepping in, warning the Republican-led state Senate that their audit of the ballots could be breaking federal laws because the ballots were turned over to a private company when they're supposed to stay in the hands of elections officials, and that plans by the company to directly contact voters could amount to voter intimidation. But there's perhaps no greater sign of just how deranged the Arizona audit is than this. An auditor telling CBS News, wait for it, they're looking for traces of bamboo in the ballots because of a baseless voter conspiracy fraud that ballots were shipped in from Asia. Watch.
Well, is that there's accusations that 40,000 ballots were flown in.
To Arizona,
and it was stuffed into the box, okay? And it came from the southeast part of the world, Asia, okay? And what they're doing is to find out if there's bamboo in the paper. That camera right there, that they take a picture of the ballot.
It's crazy that we even have to say this, that we even have to cover this story, but there is no evidence that bamboo-laced ballots were smuggled in from Asia. Okay. And while the Arizona recount has become an obsession and the central focus of the disgraced ex-president and his election fraud fantasies, his fellow travelers in the big lie all across the country are busy. They're using this fraud and these baseless concerns about voter fraud as the entire basis for passing a whole bunch of new voting restrictions. Republicans in Texas are on the verge of passing a bill that's sparking protests in the statehouse there today. Their law would curb early voting hours and drive-in voting and give more power to partisan poll watchers, even though the state's Republican attorney general spent 22,000 hours looking for voter fraud and came up with just 16 cases of false addresses on registration forms. And then there's Florida. Down in Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis turned voter suppression into a photo op today, signing a bill that adds hurdles to voting at an event that aired live on Fox News and live on Fox News only. Reporters were barred from entering or covering the event. The GOP, all in on the big lie in service of subverting democracy, is where we begin this hour with some of our favorite reporters in France. Yamiche Alcindor is here, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour, moderator of Washington Week, also on PBS. And lucky for us, she's also an MSNBC contributor. Also joining us, David Plouffe, a former Obama campaign manager, now an MSNBC political analyst. And Ryan Randazzo, reporter for the Arizona Republic. We're so happy to have you back. I'm going to get to Arizona in a second. Yamiche, I want to start with this national picture of a purge in the House Republican caucus of Liz Cheney from her leadership post, and this sort of all these proof points that the conduct and the repeating of the big lie, the walking back the truth that Kevin McCarthy has done, the outrageous performances today by the woman who would like to replace Liz Cheney, Elise Stefanik, talking about the big lie as enthusiastically as Donald Trump did, and acting like the insurrection never happened, acting like Trump supporters didn't mutilate police officers and law enforcement officials at the Capitol, and using it to push through voter suppression laws, using it for this off-the-wall, bonkers faux audit in Arizona. Is anyone concerned about where this is heading?
I think everyone is concerned about where this is heading, especially even some Republicans, those Republican secretaries of states who said over and over again during the 2020 election that the votes were not fraudulent, that this was not an election that was at all close, that Joe Biden, in fact, won by millions and millions of votes. But what you see in the Republican Party is a Republican Party that is in some ways wrestling with itself. Because you have a former president in President Trump who simply cannot let this go and who has the power in the party in a way that is really making all of the other Republicans who want to continue to have a lot of political power stand in line. So you think of someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has been ousted now from her committees. She still has all of this fundraising. So that signals to Republicans around her. She is the way forward in this party. She is the way forward talking to these Republican based voters. In talking to people, especially people that worked in the 1960s who were voting rights activists, they tell me that this is voter nullification, that we should be using that word, because what you see mm-hmm. here is not just voter suppression, where you see people targeting and trying to make it harder to vote. What's happening here in Arizona, possibly in other states, is really an auditing of the vote to look at people who they don't like how they voted and to take that out. It's something that mm-hmm. people tell me is just very, very scary, talking to activists who bled and almost died for voting rights in this country. So that's what we're up against. It's a party that is dealing with and leaning toward voter nullification.
Well, and Ryan, when you look at who they're recruiting to carry out the faux audit and perhaps some of these voter contacts, they're not recruiting from both sides of the ideological spectrum. Your reporting is really the scariest of the day. The effort to recruit people to count ballots for the ongoing audit of Maricopa County's presidential election results appears targeted in part at traditionally conservative groups. And some of the recruiters themselves appear to have far right political leanings. One recruiter is a retired police officer who works as an investigator for an extremist right-wing group that warns of, quote, the growing threat of the Marxist and Islamic movement in America. Another person involved in recruitment used her brief stint as the county Republican Party chairman to try to get Trump back in office by protesting the results of one of the county's prior audits. So it's not just voter nullification of any old Arizonan. It is a very ideologically driven effort there. And I wonder if you can update us since your last appearance about how it's going and what's going on in that room other than the hunt for bamboo.
Well, there's still some very slow counting going on, not fast enough, because, as you noted, they are going to be kicked out of that building next week for some high school graduations. And the fairgrounds say that they are not welcome to extend that lease. So I expect some sort of a fight there over whether or not they can store these ballots somewhere and then resume counting after the graduation ceremonies. But we have press there. We do have press access now in agreement with the Senate Republicans. So there are different journalists from television, newspapers, radio, with eyes on the floor every day. And every day there seems to be a new revelation about who they recruited and what they're looking for and how they're doing it.
Does anyone, Ryan, think that what they're doing is above board? Does anyone think that there were unanswered questions from the previous three recounts?
Well, the people on the floor, the ones that were recruited to do this, clearly believe in their cause. I mean, you mentioned that they had recruited sort of extremists to participate in this, and that's because those are the people. I mean, it makes sense. Those are the people that had questions about this. Most of the moderate Republicans in the state don't think that there was a need for this. I've heard from hundreds of people in the past week after reporting who was on the floor doing the counting that they just don't think that this was necessary. And now they're concerned that, you know, some people with questionable backgrounds are on the floor handling machines, handling ballots. And what is the point of all that? You know, you've got people who believe in their hearts that there was fraud, and they're the ones now doing the counting. And some of our reporting has noted, you know, that they talk amongst themselves. So they're supposed to be counting and agreeing on a number when they count 100 ballots at a time. But they're mingling and chatting with each other between here. It just doesn't seem like it's extremely strict protocols aimed at just counting ballots. You know, in some ways, it's almost a social affair. On my short time on the floor before I was kicked out, I mean, I witnessed people who were waiting like 15, 20 minutes to do anything before ballots would be brought to them. So, you know, again, not really happening fast enough and not a lot of confidence that what those folks are doing is going to come out with an accurate result.
I just want to press you, Ryan, on this, what you just said. There are people who believe in their hearts there were fraud. That's a belief, I'm sure, but it's not a fact. It's not a fact that undergirds anything happening in that room. So the whole exercise is post-fact, anti-fact. Is there growing concern that this fact-immune exercise being carried out by fact-immune people is going to lead to distrust of a Republican governor, a Trump ally, certified the vote after three recounts? Why is this still going on?
Well, you nailed it. I mean, there is distrust. There is no evidence there was any problem with the election. There is no evidence in the hand recounts of statistically significant numbers of ballots afterwards. Yet these people still believe without evidence that there is a problem. And so the people that believe most there's a problem are the ones now looking for something. It just seems very likely that they're going to come up with something, whether it's there or not. And, you know, we don't know what they're doing even with all of the equipment, because we've won access for the press to be there and for observers to be there, but we don't really know what data they took out of the voting equipment, for example. And more importantly, we don't know where this is going later. I mean, they have discussed trying to certify voters. So if they know that a person actually cast a ballot, would they actually send someone to your house and knock on your door? I mean, you know, that is what the Department of Justice is concerned with, voter intimidation, because who's going to come to the door? The cyber ninjas? And what are they going to be wearing? And how is that going to make people feel about their ability to vote freely?
David Plouffe, Ryan took us there. I mean, enter the Department of Justice, who today asserted publicly that there are concerns about the illegality of those two aspects of this specifically. One, voter intimidation by going out 6 months after an election and making contact with voters as part of their faux audit. And two, the possession by sort of out in the open conspiracy theorists of fraud that doesn't exist. So say the Republican officials in the state who engaged in three recounts to dispel distrust. What is the sort of urgency in your view for the Justice Department to be aggressive here?
It couldn't be more urgent, Nicole. And I think it's terrific that you continue to spend considerable time on this, because this is a DEFCON one moment for democracy. We're not threatened by other nations or enemies. It's a threat from within. Democracy is hanging by the thinnest thread in our country's history. And what's happening in Phoenix, Arizona, it should be happening across the border in Roswell, New Mexico. It's just crazy town. But by the way, there's no question that at the end of this ridiculous theatricality, the collection of white nationalists and QAnon supporters and Trump cult members are going to say, you know, Trump should have won Arizona. We already know the outcome. But this is deadly serious. The Department of Justice needs to be all over this, not just in Arizona, but all these efforts around the country. What's puzzling to me, Nicole, is you've got all these Republican elected officials who are in office because they chose to participate in the theater of democracy. And I'm not sure we've ever seen people in America hate democracy this much, because basically what they want to do is enshrine themselves in power. And they're doing it because they're fearful of this ridiculous, shameful, historically incompetent cult leader down in Mar-a-Lago, who they all traipse down there and pledge allegiance to. And none of them got into politics because they thought they were going to be weak-kneed and bending the ring to a cult leader. But that's where they found themselves. Issues are secondary. Their own careers, in many respects, are secondary to this fact. And so everybody who's concerned about this country, not about who wins the next election or the one after that, but the entire enterprise is at risk here. This is an existential threat. And so it's great to see DOJ getting involved. You see a lot of groups like Mark Elias's starting to file lawsuits. But what ultimately needs to happen here, and this won't solve all of this, is Congress must act. They must pass voting rights legislation. And if they don't, because a few Democratic senators decide that protecting the filibuster, which of course has its roots in slavery and racism, you're going to basically protect that so that our democracy and our country can be handled over in permanence to a party that increasingly is comfortable with white nationalism at its core, is, you know, erotic is not a strong enough word. It would be tragic.
Well, let me press you on this, David Plouffe, because we start with this every day because I see it as you just described it. This is not a story about rogue Republicans. This is at the highest levels of the Republican Party. They've greenlit this strategy. And if any, and I pray to God this all stays safe and peaceful and collaborative, the recounting of the Maricopa County ballots. But every time you greenlight an action in response to a lie, you're culpable if those actions become heated or become violent. And the culpability goes all the way to Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy probably more than anybody else. And I guess my question for you is, if the democracy is on the line, should this be more of a front burner issue for everyone who still believes in the democracy, Democrats and Republicans?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, obviously continuing to get the vaccination rates up, doing everything we can to strengthen the economy, immigration reform. These are core issues. But I think this is at the very top, because if this gets unraveled, then none of the rest of it really matters. So absolutely. I mean, I think for all the Democrats out there who worked so hard to elect Joe Biden, to get us a Democratic Senate, they have to be pressing on everybody, which is you can do all the right things on COVID, on the economy, on immigration, on criminal justice reform. If you don't take every step you can to protect this democracy, you know, you fail. Because, Nicole, you're right. I mean, we see the actions that are now happening in Arizona, Georgia, Texas, Florida, after the big and the embrace of it by basically every elected official, with a few exceptions, in Washington, Republican. What's going to happen in 2022? Now, listen, there's 50 political lifetimes between now and then, but let's say we have a bunch of close races that determine the House and Senate. We know what's going to happen. There's going to be objections to that. There's going to be Republicans, if they lose those races, won't concede, say that it was stolen. There could be violence. So this has unleashed something that could not be more dangerous into the American democracy and our society. So, yes, I think from Joe Biden on down, the very most important thing we can do, otherwise we should just pack the experiment in, is to make sure we're safeguarding our democracy. And the other side's going to fight with every fiber of their being. This is what's animating them. What's animating them is to make it harder to vote, making it harder to register, and change who's in charge of elections, which is probably the most dangerous thing of all.
I agree with everything that you've just said. And let me just add, Yamiche, that for the Republicans, it is existential as well. They do not survive unless they change the rules. They do not exist. Even as a corrupt and dark force in American life, they will perish if they do not pass voter restriction laws in every state. And if they thought they were above board, Ron DeSantis would have done an open press bill signing. He wouldn't have done it exclusively for the viewers of Fox News, which is what happened today.
That's right. And critics of the Republican Party say this. They think it's easier to cheat and to cut people out of the election and of the electoral process that they don't think will vote for them on the front end than it is to try to expand their base and to try to move past the what critics would say is the xenophobia of former President Trump and the real misogyny, critics would say, of former President Trump. So instead of adjusting their message, like you remember getting pulled into meetings in 2012 by Sean Spicer and others, Republican officials who would explain to me how they're trying to get Black and brown voters and Latino voters into the Republican Party. Now what you hear is a Republican Party that is looking at the election of 2016 and saying, we want to lean into that. We want to lean into how President Trump got elected then. They're ignoring in some ways the 2018 election and the 2020 election that proved that President Trump's message, it had a limit, and that Americans looked at it and said, well, we're going to give the Democrats control of the House and then later the control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency. This is absolutely an existential crisis. And when you talk to immigrants, especially in this country, who I I'm really leaning on for understanding about this. They say we came to America mm-hmm. because democracies are fragile, and we fled America. We fled our countries because America's democracy is supposed to be sound. And here we have a democracy that really is in this really, really tough spot. And we have to, as Americans, really openly talk about this and understand what's going on, which is really, it could be the real falling away of our democracy. It won't just be one big lie. It could be big lies if we let this continue to go on.
And the more that governors like DeSantis sign laws exclusively on Fox News and don't let anyone else in, the more evidence we have just from the Republicans and their right-wing media allies themselves that they're in on the joke. They know what they're doing. They're doing it on purpose. And repeating the lie is something designed only for their audience, who doesn't call it a lie. David Plouffe, Ryan Randazzo, thank you so much for starting us off this hour. Yamiche is sticking around with us a little longer. And when we come back, how this country has effectively turned the corner on coronavirus, swinging into full-blown reopenings, despite the nightly onslaught of lies and disinformation still pouring out on the right. Plus, President Biden today promising progress and change and compromise, but says he's sick and tired of corporate America not paying its fair share. Elizabeth Warren will join us on the first 100 plus days of the Biden presidency. We'll also ask her about the latest threat to our democracy, today's GOP, as we've been discussing all those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
After more than a year of hardships and sacrifice and loss, there are multiple signs of hope that we're at a point in the COVID pandemic where things are really turning around. The CDC optimistically announced yesterday that if most Americans get vaccinated and are careful with their day-to-day lives, COVID-19 may be under control and normal life can resume this summer, with cases falling in Michigan and several states reporting zero deaths steadily for the first time. It seems that we may be finally really turning that corner in the fight against the pandemic. But public health officials remain cautious. Surges are still expected in the coming months, but they are not expected to reach previous levels. All the while, disinformation from the right about the virus still rages on. Joining our conversation, Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean at Brown University School of Public Health, and Yamiche is still with us. Dr. Jha, what is the sort of prospect of letting the results speak to the sort of folks on the receiving end of the disinformation? It seems like when this was all an experiment and we didn't have high levels of vaccination, maybe people were more susceptible. Do you think people will look at the extinguishing of the virus and transmission and maybe not be as susceptible to that disinformation?
Yeah, so first of all, Nicole, thanks for having me on. When I look at this whole pandemic, the bottom line has been misinformation and disinformation has been a source of a lot of confusion and I think has really harmed us. I do believe that more and more Americans are looking at people getting vaccinated. A lot of people have been on the fence and they're seeing that people who are vaccinated are safe, that they can go about their daily business and do so safely. And I think it's going to help a lot of people jump off the fence. I don't think the misinformation is going to be as effective as it was early in the pandemic.
And I guess, Dr. Jha, I ask because the disinformation is getting really so much more over the top. And if you're on the fence and you don't have these other proof points in society, it's just it's hard to understand where the incentive structure comes from, but Tucker Carlson has turned to seemingly trying to tie deaths of vaccinated people to the vaccine itself. I'm not going to show it, but he laid out the number of people who died who happened to be among the vaccinated public, which is at this point largely older Americans. And I wonder if you know, what do you do about that? How do you fight that?
Yeah, so I think you fight it by sharing information and good information. Of course, I think most people realize that, like, if you're vaccinated, that doesn't prevent you from getting into a car accident. It doesn't prevent you from having a stroke or a heart attack that you would have had otherwise. And so, of course, vaccinated people are still at the same risk for everything else. They're just no longer at risk for COVID in the same way. And I think most people are smart enough to know that he's trying to manipulate. I think we just ignore that. And we focus on the evidence and science, yeah, which is that these vaccines are exceedingly safe. And they're great for getting life back to normal.
I want to turn, Yamiche, to the White House's role in this. And I'm sure you know this better than I do, but whenever I reach out to anyone about anything, the first thing they say is, look, Nicole, I'll look into that. But all I'm thinking about is getting needles into arms, getting needles into arms, getting needles into arms. It's more than a message. And it's more than sort of a policy. It is a mantra. It is their sort of melding of mission and purpose. And I wonder what their sort of mindset is about the summer. Are they cautiously optimistic? Are they white knuckled? Do they really think that we're ready to fling the doors open, especially in some of the crowded cities that were hardest hit?
My sense in talking to White House officials is that they are hopeful, but they are really determined in some ways to help the country understand just how important it is to get vaccinated. I hear the same echoes that you hear, Nicole, when I call White House officials, even if I'm talking to them about immigration or about education or other things. It still comes back to COVID, because the central topic and the central thing that the president wants everyone working for him to be focused on is how to get this country really healthy and how to get this country through this pandemic. And what I will also tell you is that I just came back from a trip from St. Louis, and it struck me in talking to people just how much fear there still is about these vaccines. I talked to so many people who said, oh, I'm not getting a vaccine because I don't know what that's going to be like. I don't know if it's going to kill me. This J&J thing really makes me very nervous about the fact that they had a positive. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done, and the Biden administration realizes that there is a lot of work to be done in talking to Americans about just how serious getting a vaccine is and just how important it is to getting to a normal summer if people can be convinced and really be under and really get to an understanding that this vaccine, it almost can't be voluntary, that it has to be seen as something as life and death, even if people around you aren't getting as sick as they were at the height of this.
You know, Dr. Jha, how much of that is handled sort of outside of government and outside of, how much of that is handled if someone works at a factory and they won't let anyone back on the line until they're vaccinated, or if the kid wants to go back on campus and be at university, they cannot live on campus unless they're vaccinated. How much of that is going to be sort of the incentive structure being the things that people want to go back to doing?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a partnership, right? So when I think about how do we help more people get ready to be vaccinated, and this is the Germans increasingly talk not so much about vaccine hesitancy, but about vaccine readiness. We have to help more Americans be ready to be vaccinated. Mm. I think government agencies have to be working with nonprofits, with kind of community leaders, religious leaders. That's going to be one part of it. And then your other part, absolutely right, private businesses, universities. My university, a lot of other universities are requiring this for students. I think that's going to be a really important force. And we sort of have to have an all hands on deck, because the bottom line is we want to put this pandemic behind us. And the best way to do that is to get a bunch more Americans vaccinated. I think it's possible, but it's going to be all of us working on this.
Another one of the president's goals, Yamiche, that they are claiming to have hit, or that they've hit, is getting as many students, younger kids, back in school. The AP is reporting that a survey conducted in March by the Education Department released Thursday found that 54% of public schools below high school levels were offering full-time classroom learning to any student who wanted it, marking steady progress since January, when that number was 46%. How do they see the sort of vaccines for younger kids coming online in the coming months as part of a back to school push? Do they plan to really push everyone? Because even in some places, in where I live in New York City, even where public school is in person, not everyone is sending their kids. And again, there are a lot of disparities there as well. So what is the thinking about selling school as safe in the fall?
Well, the first is that the president and White House officials and officials that I've been talking to, they talk about selling school as not just safe, but also as really critical to not having this real gap. When you look at equity and you look at Black and Brown students and you look at students who maybe don't have access to the same broadband as other maybe students in more affluent areas. Mm-hmm. So they're really selling it two pronged. The other thing I'll say is that the president has said that he's going to focus on three main groups. The first one, he said, is kids and getting them vaccinated. He's also going to be focusing on adults who maybe aren't hesitant, but maybe just haven't gotten around to the vaccine. And then the third, of course, is trying to get to the vaccine hesitancy. So children are on their list. And part of being healthy is going to be trying to get them vaccinated. But also they're saying we can do this in a way that makes kids safe, and we can do it in a way that cuts through so that children aren't left behind and aren't looking at now 2 years of having their schooling disrupted.
Dr. Zhao, is there any information you can share about the process for testing these vaccines on kids that might reassure people? Because I have to say it again, the right-wing disinformation has already kicked up and going in this direction.
Yeah, you know, the vaccine trials in kids are going exactly the way we do science, which is we started with adults because obviously they were the higher risk. Now we're testing it in kids through randomized trials. And the data on 12 to 15 year olds for Pfizer looks really terrific. It looks like these vaccines are very, very safe in younger, in older kids. And on younger kids, those studies are just getting going. So we're going to have to figure out what the right dose is. You know, we do this. We've done this for like lots of vaccines, lots of medicines. We're going through that same rigorous scientific process that is kind of modern American medicine.
Anyone with parents in schools has to share information about their kids' vaccination. So you're right. We do this all the time. Dr. Ashish Shah and Yumish Alcindor, thank you both so much for spending time with us and having this conversation. Up next for us, President Biden pitching his bold agenda in the red state of Louisiana today, appealing to all voters, all Americans, even the ones who didn't vote for him. Will it be enough to get past Mitch McConnell, who has now pledged to put all of his energy on stopping President Biden? Elizabeth Warren joins us on that topic next.
This is all about making a choice between giving tax breaks to super wealthy and to corporations and investing in working families. We're going to build a country. I look at this as what I'm talking about is giving essentially tax breaks to hardworking middle class and working people who built this country. In my view, it's an easy choice. Invest in workers wearing hard hats.
Today, President Biden taking his bold agenda to Louisiana and Lake Charles there, standing alongside that city's Republican mayor. The president pitching for the first time in a red state his $2.3 trillion infrastructure and jobs plan, challenging GOP lawmakers, fighting his proposed tax increases on corporations and the mega rich to pay for it. Something that most Democratic lawmakers support, including our next guest, Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's repeatedly called out major companies for paying too little while saving millions for themselves. In her new book, Persist, in which she draws from personal experience of turning struggles into opportunities for change, Warren writes this, quote, "For the first time in more than a decade, Democrats will have control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. When Republicans held a similar position in 2017, they delivered on one big promise, a $2 trillion tax cut that mostly benefited rich people. Democrats now stand at that same threshold, and we too can keep a promise. Except instead of delivering more wealth and power to the already wealthy and already powerful, we can build on an America that works better for everyone else." Joining us now is Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, a member of the Armed Services and Finance Committees and author of the new book, Persist. Thank you so much for visiting us to talk about the new book and everything else happening.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
When I look at the public support for really all of the big legislative pushes from this president, mm-hmm. I constantly wonder if your specific plans and your vigorous defenses of them play into all of the support where the president's agenda has pretty obvious intersections with things you've championed. Does that ever cross your mind?
You know, what crosses my mind is I put out 81 glorious, juicy, detailed plans that were all about making America work, not just for a handful at the top, but creating opportunity for everyone. And we're starting to put some of those in place. And I am really excited about it. This is a moment in our history when we can do this. So much has changed over the past year. And when there's this kind of turmoil, a pandemic, a racial reckoning, an armed insurrection, a new president who won by more than 7 million votes, talking about a strong government response to big problems, that means it's time. It's time for us to step up. Persist is very personal. But it's also very public, and it's very much about what we do in the next 100 days.
How do you think this president has done in the first 100 days, and how often do you talk to him?
I think that this president has met the moment. He came in at a time when things were in chaos from Donald Trump, and he made a bold promise. And it's funny, now that he's done it, you forget how bold it was. He said he was going to deliver 100 million doses of vaccine. 100 million people were going to be vaccinated in the first 100 days. And I thought that was important, not only from a public health point of view, obviously, but also for saying he was going to assess how big is the problem? And he was going to come up with a solution big enough to meet it. He was glad to do it on a bipartisan basis, invite the Republicans in. Please come join us. Give us your ideas. But if Mitch McConnell was going to put his stick in the ground and not move, then President Biden was not going to be deterred. He rolled right ahead and he helped Democrats, Republicans, and independents. Everybody who wanted a vaccine, he's out there for them.
You know, Andrew Yang has this great quote in a piece of reporting that Ashley Parker did in the Washington Post about the first 100 days. And I'm going to botch it, but it goes something like, you know, President Biden's magical power is that once President Biden is for something, it becomes the new reasonable. And I'm surprised, as sort of a former Republican, that there isn't a policy contrast being made. And I wonder sort of how much of that is that the country is on its knees and it's desperate for help and it is willing to reimagine the role of government in their lives. How much of it is sort of that sort of superpower that Andrew Yang talks about, that once President Biden's for it, it just becomes an unreasonable. And how much of it, again, is your years of work sort of softening the debates and taking some of the arrows around things you've championed for a very long time?
It's probably all of the above. But I think it's clear.
Yeah.
The American people want a government on their side. They want a government that can seriously and soberly assess what's broken and then talk about solutions. And look, when I talk about America, I'm not just talking about what Democrats want. Minimum wage passed in Florida last year, paid leave in Colorado, new education, taxing rich people so you could put more money into education, passed in Arizona. The things that we're out there advocating for, Americans want. A progressive agenda, childcare, cancel student loan debt, a wealth tax. Those are things America's ready for. Those are things that I like to think most Democrats are ready to get in there and fight for. It's the Republicans in Washington who are just out of step. And when Mitch McConnell says he thinks as a public servant that he was elected to go to Washington to do nothing and to block anything that comes up, no matter how big the problem is, no matter how good the solution that Joe Biden and the Democrats put forward is, then what Mitch McConnell is really saying is that he's the one who's unreasonable, He's out of step, and he is not and does not want to be part of the whole governing process.
I mean, you just articulated what is perhaps one of the most under-noted accomplishments, in my view, of the first 100 days. This White House has successfully redefined bipartisanship in America for that which has bipartisan support in America. And Republicans aren't even part of the conversation. And I wonder, Senator, if you think, in your view, do you think they want to be part of the conversation? Do you think they, I mean, when you look at the poll, if we look at the polls and support for the tax increases to help pay for the agenda, there's bipartisan support for the tax increases. When you ask, how are you going to pay for it? You're going to pay for it by taxing corporations and the super rich. I mean, I wonder if they don't have a hand to play. So that's why they're, you know, trotting down to Mar-a-Lago and championing the big lie. I mean, do you think it's sort of policy bankruptcy, or do you think it's they don't have a hand?
Yeah, I think you've said this exactly right, Nicole. I think President Biden was exactly right when he basically redefined bipartisanship by saying if Democrats, Republicans, and independents across the country want it, that's bipartisan, and I'm going forward with it. And I think what's going on right now is that 40 years of trickle-down economics, 40 years in which the answer to every question that you asked a Republican was cut taxes and cut regulations, or let me translate that, help the rich and the powerful get richer and more powerful, that string has run out. And that enough Americans in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of what's been a K-shaped recovery, in the middle of seeing their children at home, of mamas who can't go back to work, of people who say, where is our government? What the Republicans have to offer is just not what America wants. And I don't mean by a little bit. I mean not what America wants by a big chunk.
As someone who made some of those arguments, I have to ask you if you're surprised that Republicans are also deprived now of arguments that the economy will suffer. I mean, the economy is not suffering, and President Biden has really pursued a very bold and a very expensive agenda.
That's right. But that doesn't stop the Republicans. Their answer to everything, right? Cut taxes. Their answer to everything, vote, deregulate. And don't bother them with data about what's actually happening. You know, I think that what's so important here is to understand that if we, for example, put a wealth tax in place, I'm going to take an even bolder step here, a wealth tax, that is a tax on fortunes bigger than $50 million, 2-cent tax, a little bit more if you have a billion, that would produce over the next 10 years about $3 trillion. We can add to that a tax on real corporate profits, that is the book profits of corporations. That would give us roughly about another $1.5 trillion. That's the kind of money that would let us provide universal childcare, universal pre-K, put real investments, quadruple the funding in our Title I schools, and put real money into K-12. It would let us put money in for universal tuition-free technical school, two-year college, four-year college. It would let us cancel a big chunk of student loan debt and still have money left over to invest in this economy. But that's why it is a real economic theory of how the world works, one that's borne out with data. You make those investments in people, in opportunity, and it pays off in more productivity, higher standard of living, more families that do better. If I can, I'll just tell you a very quick story about how starting in the 1970s, women, mamas, started going back to work and productivity started going up. By about 2000, they just quit doing it. It was too hard to get childcare, too hard to manage it all. So it flattens out, and what happens? Productivity flattens out. We make investments in each other, And it's also about investing in our economy overall. Democrats are the ones who have the ideas about how to build a strong country going forward, not just for a handful of rich people, but to build a strong country for everyone.
Senator Warren, I'm going to ask you to stick around through a break. I want to ask you, as someone who ran to be the president of this country, if you're concerned about the state of our democracy, given the state of the Republican Party. Stay with us.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
We're back with Senator Elizabeth Warren. Senator, the last time we spoke at length. You were so kind to join our COVID memorial show, and we talked a lot about your brother. And so I read those parts of the book first, and I want to read one of them. In late January 2020, I called my brother from somewhere in Iowa. Over the next week or so, he started feeling pretty sick. Pneumonia, the doctor said. And they put him in the hospital in Norman. After a few days on antibiotics, Don Reed spent part of a phone call arguing with me about whether Trump had done anything wrong in pressuring the Ukrainian government for dirt on Joe Biden. I smiled. He was getting better. I think if anyone has family members who sort of have those politics, this story really resonates, because obviously when somebody you love is sick, you don't care who they support. But I wonder what your worries are about the direction that the Republican Party has taken since Trump lost and cost them control of the Senate.
You know, thank you. This book is a very personal story. It's a story about what I bring to the policy fights. And it's about being a mother and a teacher and a planner, a fighter, a learner, a woman. I talk about how policy touches us so directly, including Donald Trump's failure to have any policy response on COVID. I am so deeply concerned about where Donald Trump is dragging the Republicans. Look what happened in Florida today. That instead of saying as a state, let's do what we can to make sure that every citizen gets a chance to vote, instead it looked like some kind of political rally where the governor on Fox News, with no one else around, signs into law a bill that he practically holds up a sign saying, I think this is going to help more Republicans get elected. Mm-hmm. And that just feeds more into the, we don't have to worry about truth. Donald Trump wants Republicans to bend a knee to the big lie. We don't have to worry about democracy. Donald Trump, the governor of Florida, and so many others are saying, let's reshape voting in America so that Republicans will have a better chance to win. We don't have to care, they're saying, about the future of our nation. Because what they care about, what Mitch McConnell cares about, what Donald Trump cares about is power, power for themselves, not strength and power for our nation.
Yeah, or the democracy, it would seem. Senator Elizabeth Warren, it's a pleasure to get to talk to you. Congratulations on the book. It is must read for our times. Thank you so much for spending some time with us to talk about it. Elizabeth Warren's new book, Persist, is out now. The next hour of Deadline White House starts after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Once I was, you know, able to kind of steady myself, get my bearings, like I was just surrounded in this sea of people, rioters, and they just started attacking me from all directions. You know, I experienced a group of individuals that were trying to kill me to accomplish, you know, their goal. How we managed to make it out of that day without more significant loss of life is a miracle.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in the East. A haunting and terrifying account there from Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone of the deadly insurrection that took place 4 months ago today. For Fanone and the other officers at the Capitol on January 6th, the emotional wounds and trauma are still very raw. Yesterday, he penned a letter to all elected members of the U.S. government that reads in part, quote, "The fighting here was nothing short of brutal. As the physical injuries gradually subsided, in crept the psychological trauma. I struggled daily with the emotional anxiety of having survived such a traumatic event. But I also struggle with the anxiety of hearing those who continue to downplay the events of that day and those who would ignore them altogether with their lack of acknowledgement. The indifference shown to my colleagues and I is disgraceful. The time to fully recognize these officers' actions is now." His anger and frustration, no doubt exacerbated by the GOP's latest war against one of their own, Liz Cheney, for doing what Fanone is asking for acknowledging the horror and seeking to hold those responsible to account. While Cheney has spelled out in black and white who incited the rioters, the ex-president, the continued threat of the big lie, and the extremism it inspires, others in the GOP have downplayed what happened. Like when Senator Ron Johnson called the insurrectionists festive, and when Trump said they posed zero threat. We even saw a dozen House Republicans vote against a resolution to honor the police who protected their lives that day with congressional gold medals. Acknowledgement of the danger of the big lie is at the heart of the GOP's campaign against Cheney. In her powerful op-ed in the Washington Post today, she makes a plea to fully investigate the events of January 6th and expose the lies. Quote, "We must support a parallel bipartisan review by a commission with subpoena power to seek and find facts. It will describe for all Americans what happened. This is critical to defeat the misinformation and nonsense circulating in the press and on social media. No currently serving member of Congress with an eye to the upcoming election cycle should participate. We should appoint former officials, members of the judiciary, and other prominent Americans who can be objective, just as we did after the attacks of September 11, 2001. The commission should be focused on the January 6th attacks. The Black Lives Matter and Antifa violence of last summer was illegal and reprehensible, but it is a different problem with a different solution. Cheney's words there striking for their urgency and for the daylight they represent between Cheney and the entire rest of her caucus on the importance of the investigation and its scope. Kevin McCarthy and other Republicans have advocated for the commission to, of course, include a look at Black Lives Matter protesters and Antifa, even though everyone knows, even them, that they were not behind the January 6th riot. But there might be more to McCarthy's pushback on a 1-6 commission, as Politico points out today. Quote, "The reality is that any bipartisan commission on January 6th would almost certainly include a subpoena of McCarthy, whose call with Trump will become a central focus of any investigation. That would put McCarthy in a tough spot, forced to recount on record things Trump may not want out there." The GOP continuing to push the big lie while failing to take seriously the threat it emboldens is where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Ben Rhodes is here, former deputy national security advisor to President Obama and an MSNBC contributor. Also joining us, Tim O'Brien, senior columnist at Bloomberg Opinion. And Tim Miller's back, writer at large at The Bulwark and former communications director for Jeb Bush's campaign. Ben Rhodes, I want to read you a little more of Liz Cheney's op-ed in today's Washington Post. She writes this, I've worked overseas in nations where changes in leadership come only with violence, where democracy takes hold only until the next violent upheaval. America is exceptional because our constitutional system guards against that. At the heart of our republic is a commitment to the peaceful transfer of power among political rivals in accordance with law. President Ronald Reagan described this as our American miracle. Clearly, Trump rendered that miracle not the case anymore. And I think what's stunning to someone like Liz Cheney is that with this opportunity to turn the page, he's deplatformed, he lost, and then he went and lost those two Senate seats. The Republicans had every opportunity, and Tim Miller is so smart to always make these points. They're making affirmative choices now to continue down the path of the big lie, the insurrection, and all the danger it exposes the country to. Why?
Well, what's so extraordinary looking at this, Nicole, is what do they disagree with that Liz Cheney's saying? These are not like she's not disavowing the Republican Party's philosophy on governing, on immigration, on taxation. She's simply saying that a violent insurrection that sought to overturn American democracy and led to the deaths of people at the workplace of her and her colleagues should be investigated, and that party officials should no longer continue to lie and say that Donald Trump somehow won the election or that there were all these fraudulently cast ballots. Like, that's basically someone saying that the party should live on planet Earth and acknowledge that the sky is blue and 2 + 2 = 4. And that, oh, by the way, as elected representatives of a democracy, we should oppose people who seek to violently overthrow that democracy. And the fact that not only can her colleagues not join her in that, but the simple act of saying and doing that could get her evicted from her leadership position, could potentially cost her support in her own primary, is absolutely extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I mean, it situates this party as a truly radical kind of far right movement, not a kind of center right party that happens to have disagreements with the Democrats. And it puts us in danger. It puts us in danger because the more politicians are winking at the big lie, the more some people are going to take that seriously, and they're going to be future January 6s, whether they're on a small scale or a big scale like that. And also, it makes us look absolutely ridiculous at a time when, as Joe Biden says, there's this competition between democracy and authoritarianism. Can you imagine if Boris Johnson, you know, who I don't agree with about many things, if he tried to overthrow the results of an election leading to like a violent insurrection at the House of Commons, like, does anybody doubt that the British Conservative Party wouldn't disavow that? Of course they would. We are in uncharted territory here as a democracy.
And Tim O'Brien, the letter from Officer Fanone and his speaking out, I guess I would say I'm old enough to remember when the Republican Party would recoil at a critique like that. I think Republicans like to think of themselves as appealing to law enforcement households and law enforcement families. But their disdain for the law enforcement officials who protected them that day is now part of the brand. It's now who they are.
Right. The party of law and order has turned its back on law and order. And the common thread between what Liz Cheney is saying and Officer Fanone is that they are asking Republicans to look at reality and look at the fact pattern and make decisions and put their principles in front of those sort of things, rather than a cult of personality. But, you know, we were warned of this, about this, for a very long time at the Republican convention. A year ago, they had no platform. They merely created an event that was designed to foster a cult of personality around Donald Trump at the expense of developing an agenda of public policy decisions to make positions to make the country better. The Republicans rallied around Trump's big lie about the election being overthrown, and they've now tried to create this barrier of propaganda and myth around the events of January 6th to do the same thing. And the reason for that is they have learned from Donald Trump that propagandizing, lying, abusing the rule of law, and cynically misleading your own supporters is an effective path to power. And that's why I think we're in such a dangerous moment right now, as Ben just flagged. I think we are in a very unusual place when we see a major party with deep historical roots deciding that the best way to position itself publicly is to gaslight working Americans into believing that they're going to come up with policies that not only address white supremacy and domestic terrorism, but practical matters too, like infrastructure, national security, healthcare and childcare for working women. There are crickets from the Republicans on every one of these issues, and their affluent supporters are happy to be behind that because they can move forward. But working members of the Republican Party are getting snookered here.
You know, Tim, we had this sort of narrative that set in covering Trump's footsie and coordination on messages, everything from the Russian efforts in Afghanistan to just about every time Russia came up, the analysis was offered that even Putin is probably surprised by how well his meddling paid off. I wonder if the same is true about Donald Trump. I wonder sometimes if even Donald Trump is dismayed that the entire Republican Party, from the top to the bottom in Congress, with the exception of Liz Cheney, from the top to the bottom in every state Republican Party, from the top to the bottom in every legislature controlled by Republicans, is now rolling over and being almost more subservient to him in disgrace defeat than they were while he was president.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt he's dismayed, Nicole, but I bet he's even surprised. You know, I mean, he's the wedding singer MC of Mar-a-Lago right now. He's got no power at all, and all these people are still doing whatever he damn well pleases, you know? And so, look, I just posted something on the Bulwark, but there was this great quote, in air quotes, on November 9th, right after the election, from this top Republican official in background in The Washington Post. And he or she said, "What's the downside for humoring him for a little while longer as their justification for going along with the big lie?" You know, 2 months later, we saw the downside. We just heard in the intro to this segment from Officer Fanone, who is still dealing with the very serious physical and emotional and psychological consequences of the downside. And yet 3 months after that, that is what they're all saying again. Like, that is what this whole fight between Liz Cheney and Elise Stefanik is about. What is the downside for humoring him? Elise Stefanik's willing to humor him. She's willing to go on Steve Bannon's podcast this morning and say, you know, that audit of the Arizona vote, there might be something there. We should keep our eye on that, Steve. That's what Elise was saying this morning. On the podcast of one of the drivers of the insurrection. And all Liz Cheney is trying to say is, I don't think we should humor him any longer. So that is what this is all about. They all have seen what happened and they're still willing to humor him. And I do agree, Nicole, he's got to be kind of like even surprised, you know, the dog that caught the car on this a little bit, like surprised himself that these people who were supposedly important leaders in the country are willing to just go along with this charade.
So I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to do this because you raised this. I have this tape of Elise Stefanik. And for anyone who doesn't know who she is, this is the nicest thing I can say about her. She's not stupid. So when you keep that in mind, when you listen to the things she's about to say, she's also not as conservative as Liz Cheney. So there's no ideology behind why Steve Scalise and Kevin McCarthy are sticking knives in Liz Cheney's back and picking Elise Stefanik. But when you listen to this interview of her with Steve Bannon, who I think didn't he get one of the last pardons after he was charged with some felonies, this is her talking to him about the big lie.
Key battles of the Revolutionary War, standing up for our constitutional liberties, were fought in my district. And the president has been our strongest supporter of any president when it comes to standing up for the Constitution. When you talk to any voter across this country, certainly at any Republican event, they are focused on election security and election integrity. It is important to stand up for these constitutional issues. And these are questions that are going to have to be answered before we head into the 2022 midterms so that the American people have faith in our election system.
So, Tim, I played that because, and it's important to know that Elise Stefanik is not stupid in the context of this sentence. When you talk to any voters across this country, certainly at any Republican event, they are focused on election security and election integrity. The reason they're focused on election security and integrity is because they've been lied to. for 6 months now by people like Elise Stefanik, who know there was no voter fraud. And I wonder, Tim, and keep it real here, is there any chance of breaking the fever when the corruption is so solid?
No, I mean, if there would be anybody, you'd think it would be Elise Stefanik, right? I mean, you're saying that she's not stupid. I just want to add to that. Look, she worked with me at the RNC on that famed autopsy that talked about how we need to expand our reach in the party. She wrote for the Weekly Standard, which was the magazine that got shut down for being too anti-Trump and kind of re-evolved into the bulwark. She, in 2016, wouldn't even say Trump's name on the campaign trail and recruited other anti-Trump candidates to run in 2018. She knows exactly what she's doing. And that clip that you played, as gross and disgusting as it was, acting like she's not sure about election integrity, didn't even play the most ridiculous part, which was when she goes on to talk about Arizona and this audit where they're claiming that they're checking the ballots. This is not a joke, Nicole. They're claiming they're checking the ballots to see if there's bamboo from China on them. Like, that is how stupid this audit is in Arizona. And she was on there with Steve Bannon saying, this is really something we need to look into. So, no, I mean, if someone like Elise, this is not Louie Gohmert, you know, this is not Marjorie Taylor Greene. If somebody like Elise Stefanik is going to pass this stuff, how does the fever break?
I think that's the truth. I want to sort of pull this back to the real danger that the big lie and Elise Stefanik repeating the big lie represents. NBC's reporting that the FBI is still after the worst of the worst in the Capitol riot, as new arrests still come at a steady pace. 4 months after the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol, FBI agents maintain a steady pace of arresting people accused of taking part as one of the largest criminal investigations in American history keeps growing. Quote, we're not done rounding up the worst of the worst, said one law enforcement official. We're not slowing down. More than 440 people have been charged with taking part in the Capitol siege, coming from all but five states. I wonder, Ben Rhodes, how the FBI sort of plays whack-a-mole when the thing that inspired the violence is almost at a higher pitch now than it was before the violence.
Yeah, I mean, they're arresting the foot soldiers, but not the people who did the radicalizing, not the people who made the whole thing possible, obviously. And, you know, when I hear that clip, what's so chilling about that, and you're right to make the point that this is a smart person. I'm imagining the people listening to this, you know, as was said, like kind of the working people who just are fed every time they turn on their talk radio dial, every time they click on Fox News, every time they open their Facebook feed to get what the algorithm kind of mainlined into their news feed. Or when they turn on Steve Bannon's podcast, they're told that the election was stolen. They're told that there are these concerns. And when you have, as someone who had to look at radicalization from the standpoint of how do we deal with groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, part of the challenge is when you have people who are credible in communities, and what is more credible than an elected official vested with the power of the United States government and the House of Representatives telling you, winking at you, the conspiracy theory is real. What is that doing to those people? And some of those people, as we've already seen, can be so radicalized that they will put their lives at risk charging the U.S. Capitol, and they will kill people. That has happened. We saw that with our own eyes. All of us saw that. And yet these people are still doing that. It is so beyond irresponsible. It is dangerous. It is going to get people killed. And it is also going to put this democracy at risk. Because the thing that I keep thinking about, Nicole, right, as a Democrat, you know, when you add up redistricting with the voting laws that are passed, with just how things tend to go in midterm elections, it's more likely than not that Kevin McCarthy, a man who has earned nothing, a man who has disgraced himself, a man who has shown himself to have no principle that he will put over the pursuit of power, is probably the most likely person to be the next Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives. Like, this is not over. This, I'm glad you keep coming back to this issue, Nicole, because this is not over. This did not end on January 20th. Like, there is a very real threat to American democracy and American national security that is happening all around us right now. And until there are more Liz Cheneys, right, someone who I've probably agreed with about nothing for the last decade or two, until there are more of those people who are willing to stand up, this problem is not going to go away, and it is likely to get worse.
On that note, Ben Rhodes and Tim Miller, thank you for starting us off this hour. It is unbelievable. Thank you for both of your insights. Tim O'Brien is sticking around. After the break for us, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis getting real cozy today with Fox News and what that suggests about the political motivations behind his new voting restrictions. Plus, Rudy Giuliani's money troubles and why recent history suggests Donald Trump should take them as a warning sign, and why vaccine companies might not be too pleased with the president today, but why the president is digging in anyway. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Why did you only allow Fox News to capture the moment you signed the controversial election bill?
So we did a wonderful bill signing for this great elections bill, and it was live on national television on Fox and Friends, and we were happy to give them the exclusive on that. And I think it went really, really well. We got a lot of great feedback on it, and we're proud that we were able to do it on national television.
That was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in all of his glory after signing into law this morning exclusively on Fox News and only in front of their viewers his state's version of voting restrictions that further peddle the big lie that there was fraud in 2020. Florida's bill is similar to the other bills that have been discussed in state legislatures all around the country. It definitely makes it harder to vote this way, by making it harder to vote by mail, by restricting the use of drop boxes, and by prohibiting any actions that could influence voters in line at polling places. And all of this happened, was signed into law on Fox News by Ron DeSantis, despite Ron DeSantis saying that his past election was the, quote, most transparent and efficient election in the country. He said more than 4.8 million Floridians, more than 40% of the fall electorate, cast mail ballots, many of them Republicans. The bill is already facing swift backlash, with two lawsuits already filed against it. And one state senator from Florida didn't mince words today when discussing the new restrictions, saying, quote, this blatant voter suppression is Jim Crow 2.0 and will make it harder for voters from low-income rural white communities to the elderly to communities of color to have their voices heard. Joining our conversation is Professor Michael Eric Dyson, distinguished professor at Vanderbilt University and the author of the book Tears We Cannot Stop, now out in paperback. And Joyce Vance is here, former U.S. attorney, professor at the University of Alabama School of Law, and an MSNBC contributor. Professor, I want to start with you, and I want to ask you why the conversation on the left and frankly on the side of anyone who believes in increasing access to voting isn't about more than whack-a-mole, isn't about, you know, why isn't the counter-proposal, let's make it easier for everyone to vote. If you can buy a car and a house on your phone, maybe you should be able to vote there too.
Well, that would make too much sound too much like sense and good sense. Not less voting, more voting. Not restricted voting, but unrestricted voting. Let's maximize the potential of American democracy and its citizens to embrace it. Let's open the door wide so that people are able to walk through the voting polls and pull that lever and register their opinion about American democracy. It is, you know, it used to be confusing that those on the right side, instead of trying to facilitate a transition to a voting populace that has the maximum capacity to say what they feel in this country, they are now on the side of those who would want to restrict it. Now, we know historically voter restriction, voter suppression has been the calling card for the right wing. And they can dress it up as being concerned about safe voting and fair voting. But we all know if you're trying to outlaw the ability of people in the hot Florida sun to receive a bottle of water or a plate of food from somebody who's helping them, your intent is not to support voting. Your intent is to suppress voting. And let's be honest about it. In an ugly way, it is geared toward people of color so that the representative who said this is, you know, Jim Crow 2.0, this is Jim Jane Crow, this is Sally and every other crow that we can imagine in that family flying low to deprive people of the right to vote. It's pretty shameful and a sad day in American democracy.
And I guess, Joyce, my sort of understanding of this is that I understand that Republicans are doing this because it is an existential threat to them if as many people who voted in 18 and 20 vote in 22 and 24. They know they can't win elections. So this is ball game for them. This is the whole thing. And they all know that there was no voter fraud, because if there was, Bill Barr was very happy to pursue it and find it and prosecute it. And we know that because he said it. He said it on TV. So my question, I guess, is the same one to you. Why isn't the response from a bipartisan coalition who believes that the right to vote is inherent, and that because there was no voter fraud, voter suppression laws aren't what's needed, voter access laws are what needed. Why isn't the pie... Why isn't the kind of counteroffensive not to fight these laws in Republican legislatures, but to get the business community not just to boycott the bad laws, but to support bills that would expand access to the right to vote?
I guess the problem is that you're not running strategy on this issue, because that's absolutely the right way for it to be handled. But I would say this, the Democrats' strategy has been to have a national response to what's going on in the states. And that's really the only possible response that they can craft in this legal system. The problem is that after the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby County versus Holder, which gutted the Voting Rights Act, DOJ's ability to challenge state changes to voting practices that had racially discriminatory impact or intent was really, really minimized. The ability of private parties like the Legal Defense Fund or the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights that have a history of going against these discriminatory practices was also minimalized. And so what we now have is this effort in Congress to pass the John Lewis Act, to restore the Voting Rights Act, to make it easier for people to vote. And that, of course, all hinges on the outcome of that bill in the Senate. In the meantime, these states are racing to make it more difficult for people to vote. I think it's important just to cap the conversation by saying the Brennan Center, which tracks this sort of exercise in state legislatures, estimates that 47 states have now introduced 361 measures that would make it more difficult to vote. And the states where those measures are the most predominant are the states that are becoming majority-minority states more quickly than expected: Arizona, Texas, Georgia. So the Republican strategy here is clearly one of voter suppression. I think sometimes we move past that too quickly. And it's not a partisan issue. It's not Democrats who should be saying this. It's all of us who should be noting that voting is a right, not a privilege in this country. We can all disagree about who we should vote for, but we need to restore this foundational American belief that everybody gets to vote and it should be easy to do so.
So that number is updated, and I'm glad you brought that Brennan study to our attention. It used to be 48 states looking at 108 different laws, but Joyce is right, Professor. They're close to 400 laws, and you have to say it every single time. Nearly 400 laws designed to solve a problem that doesn't exist. There is no systematic voter fraud in this country. There wasn't any in 2000. There isn't any. And I remember when James Baker and Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter, looked at it, they didn't find any. Former Republican campaign lawyer Ben Ginsburg said there wasn't any until Donald Trump asked his voters in North Carolina to vote twice. If they'd done that, it would have been a felony. And I want to pick up on what Joyce said. Is it time to push for the legislation to be passed at the federal level because of that, because 47 states are looking at close to 400 laws? I mean, is it time to really push the conversation about the filibuster?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Two things. Listen to Black people who have been leading on this forever. Black people who have been saying this, election cycle in, election cycle out. They have been repeating this. Women have been repeating this. Progressives have been saying this. But especially when it becomes a Black versus white issue, it loses some of its steam, even on the left. In an era where we've seen an attack on, quote, woke politics and conscientious responses, so that even corporations which have taken up their role of publicly inveighing against these vicious and horrible laws, they've been dismissed by Mitch McConnell and others as, you know, woke policemen, and they ought to stay out of politics. Strange, McConnell now wants them to stay out of politics when he lauded the Supreme Court for saying that they were basically, you know, human with flesh and that these corporations ought to have a right. You know, it's also a criticism of the left and the Democrats, especially. The Democrats used to say the feds led, the locals were yokels, right? So we got rid of them. Let's not deal with the local stuff. Let's deal with the federal stuff. But what we see now, the ingenuity, as cruel and crass as it is, of the Republicans is the local is where we are focal, our focal point, because we're going to change it because the federal government has limited abilities. Even if the John Lewis law passes, which I hope and pray it does, the ability to apply federal mandates against local strictures is counter to many of these states' belief that they sit on their own tub, on their own bottom, in their own silo. And how dare the federal government try to impose its arbitrary will upon them? So, yes, we need both and not either or. A strong federal response, corporate citizens and the rest of us should be involved. But progressives must step up to the plate. Democrats must step up to the plate and say, enough is enough. This is not about black versus white. This is right versus wrong. And either you're going to be on the right side or the wrong side.
Michael Eric Dyson, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for spending some time with us today. Joyce Vance is sticking around. Coming up for us, did you know Rudy Giuliani used to travel all around New York City with an entourage of five people? Well, not so much anymore, now that Donald Trump has left him high and dry with mounting legal bills. Why the former president might want to think twice about that. Next.
He turned around and he told people, you know, if that person starts screaming in the crowd, I give you permission to beat him up and don't worry, I'll pay your legal fees. Well, fortunately for a lot of people that they didn't do that because Donald Trump would never pay you legal fees. And you could take that to the bank because I'm right now in litigation with him on the exact same topic.
To borrow one of Donald Trump's old lines, Rudy, if you're listening, signs today that Rudy Giuliani is facing a real cash crunch as his legal troubles pile up. Politico is reporting that Giuliani has cut down on his personal entourage over the last few weeks, seeking to, quote, cut costs. This on the heels of the New York Times reporting that Giuliani's advisors believe Trump should pay his pricey legal bills, a fruitless request. If you ask Michael Cohen, the Times reporting this, quote, Mr. Giuliani led the effort to subvert the results of the 2020 race in a series of battleground states, but he was not paid for the work, according to people close to Giuliani and Trump. His supporters now want the Trump campaign to tap into the $250 million it raised in the weeks after the election to pay Giuliani and absorb costs he has incurred in the defamation suits. That's not to mention the federal investigation he's facing over his conduct in Ukraine. And as the pressure ramps up on Rudy, George Conway warns in a new op-ed today that could mean legal exposure for the former president. Quote, if Giuliani has anything to offer prosecutors to save himself, it would have to be Trump, the only bigger fish left. And it was arguably criminal for the then president to have used his official powers to try to coerce foreign officials into aiding his reelection campaign. In fact, Giuliani's admission that he wasn't conducting foreign policy, but merely helping Trump personally, is exactly what would make the scheme prosecutable. The former guy just might want to rethink stiffing Giuliani on those bills. We're back with Tim O'Brien and Joyce Vance. Joyce, this feels muddled, frankly. I mean, if Trump starts just injecting cash into Rudy's bank account, right when Rudy is faced with a decision about whether or not to cooperate in an investigation that could lead to Donald Trump, does that expose Trump to obstruction or bribery charges potentially?
The whole situation is really fraught on both sides. Certainly, if Trump did that, there would be that suspicion based on how all of this is evolving with Rudy Giuliani's supporters saying that they've spoken with the president's legal team demanding these sort of payments. It could just be characterized as a payment on a debt that was owing, but Trump has maintained all along that he would pay Giuliani only for expenses and not for legal fees associated with his post-election work. So it would give off that sort of an odor. And it would certainly be interesting in the context that we're seeing now where Giuliani has previously said that he's got some insurance, that if he were ever to be indicted, that he has material that he could turn over. I think George Conway nails it when he suggests that the former president would be the most likely person that Giuliani could convince federal prosecutors he should be permitted to cooperate against. And so Trump proceeds at his peril no matter what he does here, seemingly.
I want to read some more of the Conway op-ed that Joyce referenced, Tim. George Wright says, federal prosecutors in Manhattan tried to get permission last fall for a Giuliani raid, but were rebuffed by senior officials serving under Trump. Last June, for reasons still opaque, then Attorney General Barr ousted the U.S. attorney there and tried to handpick a successor. If any of that was intended to protect Giuliani or Trump himself, it might end up backfiring spectacularly. If a warrant had been executed before January 20th, it's hard to imagine that Trump wouldn't have pardoned Giuliani out of spite, self-interest, or both. And frankly, there was some reporting that it was on the table that he might have pardoned himself. Why do you think he didn't?
Well, I still think that's the million-dollar question. I Donald Trump is motivated most of the time by his emotions and animus. It's not, he is not a strategic thinker. And I doubt any time this came before him about how to treat Giuliani, he was trying to watch this unspool into the future and wonder about how it might come back to haunt him. You know, after all, his relationship with Rudy goes back decades. It was a mystery to those of us covering Rudy and Trump in New York in the 1980s when Rudy was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District, why he wasn't taking a closer look back then at allegations of possible money laundering and Trump's proximity to members of organized crime in New York. It sort of skated under the radar. It was attributed back then to the fact that Rudy had his eyes on City Hall, and he knew that Trump would be an important ally if he wanted to do that one day. And since then, Rudy has essentially been a bag man and a sort of dirty ops operator for Trump. So he knows a lot. And it is in Trump's interest to keep Rudy on his side. But the issue of legal fees is interesting because Donald Trump doesn't even pay his own legal fees. So the idea that he would open up his wallet to pay someone else's is beyond the pale. And I think if he does it now, I don't think anyone should be under the impression that this is paying a legal fee. It is paying hush money. And that's what it amounts to. And I think if that becomes witness tampering, or if law enforcement officials see it as witness tampering, that's going to be problematic for Trump.
And paying hush money is literally the crime that named him the nickname Individual One in Michael Cohen's sentencing filings. Tim O'Brien and Joyce Vance, we will stay on it with your help. Thank you for being part of this conversation today. Up next for us, why President Biden's latest vaccine announcement could drive a bit of a wedge around some issues with vaccine makers. That's next. The Biden administration making a new announcement that it supports waiving COVID-19 vaccine patent protections. It's a move that could benefit global vaccine production. That's after sustained pressure from more than 100 low and middle income countries, along with some Democratic lawmakers. But on the other side, there are some concerns surrounding the move. From the Washington Post reporting on this story, quote, the drug industry said that the move would backfire, with the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America predicting that allowing more manufacturers to begin making shots would spark new competition for limited ingredients, slow down existing production, and even lead to counterfeit vaccines. Let's bring into our conversation MSNBC medical contributor, Dr. Vin Gupta, pulmonologist and global health policy expert. Can you explain this decision that the Biden administration has made and really what the two choices they were facing really meant?
Of course, Nicole. Good afternoon. So essentially, there's a clause, it's intellectual property that governs the development of vaccines in this case, or even drugs like insulin, where the maker is protected and has property rights over the development of you name it, the COVID vaccine or any type of drug. And so that prevents a third party manufacturer from looking at a list of ingredients and making their own version of it. And the problem here is that that's limiting supply. And the big issue here, Nicole, is let's take Pfizer, for instance. Pfizer is claiming that this is going to tamp down innovation. Their trade organizations are saying the same thing. But it's just confusing to understand that when you just look at the facts. Pfizer got billions of dollars in pre-purchase agreements from the United States when we didn't know if you would even have had a workable vaccine. That's number one. Early in 2020, they got those contracts. And then Germany gave BioNTech, its partner manufacturer, over €500 million in R&D funding. So a lot of public investment went into these vaccines. You know how much, Nicole, Pfizer made in Q1 from its COVID vaccine? At least $3.5 billion of profit. So the question here is, how much do they want to profit off of an R&D process that was significantly funded by the public and the American taxpayer in this case? It just doesn't square with reality. And so that argument that somehow in a once-in-a-century pandemic, let's remove intellectual property, that's somehow going to tamp down innovation. Well, this was funded but largely by the American taxpayer. So it is our vaccine. It's the world's vaccine in this case because it got multinational support.
Dr. Gupta, what happens next? Does the president have the power to make them do this? And will other countries start making the vaccines now?
Well, not necessarily. So this is now up to the World Trade Organization to ultimately levy a decision as to whether this IP is going to actually be waived, the patent protections in the case of the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, or potentially for all of them. So we'll see. So it's an open question. And the EU in and of itself, where BioNTech is based, has not committed to following through with a similar promise. So it's very much an open question whether or not this is going to really change anything in the short term, but it's the right first step.
Dr. Gupta, thank you for making sense of those headlines for us today. It's always nice to see you. When we return, as we do every single day, we will remember lives well lived. Today, we honor the life of Kara Bluth, a New Jersey vice principal beloved by students and parents and faculty alike. One of her friends told NBC 10 in Philadelphia that one of Kara's passions was reading. It's a love she tried to pass on to students. She'd occasionally dress up in costume, acting out different characters just to make the children's day a little more magical. Kara's obituary says she made every room brighter just by entering it. From her soul, she exuded joy, laughter, and love. It's tragic. Kara Bluth passed after a fight with COVID-19 in February. We are thinking of her, her husband, her family, her friends, and her students during what must be an extraordinarily difficult and painful time. We will be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We're grateful.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.